Without a doubt, Afghanistan has become Barack Obama's most significant and pressing foreign policy challenge. The new president has ordered tens of thousands more U.S. troops into the country in an attempt to turn around a conflict that America has been losing to the Taliban. But echoes of Iraq are becoming more apparent. This is now America's bloodiest war. The number of U.S. soldiers being killed is rising fast. Civilian casualties are higher than ever before. And war profiteers are making a killing as they pour into the conflict. This week on Fault Lines, we examine Obama's war and ask, what is the United States trying to achieve in Afghanistan? And will it really make America safer? Afghanistan is where empires go to die. After 8 years, the U.S. finds itself doing a little better than the British and Soviet empires of before. Up till now, top American commanders openly admitted they were losing to the Taliban. Barack Obama staked his campaign on the claim that Iraq was a distraction from America's most important front, Afghanistan. Now that campaign rhetoric has turned into real actions and very real deaths. As beleaguered units are pulled out of Iraq, thousands of troops flow from one counterinsurgency into another. As new battle lines are drawn, new questions are raised. Can an Iraqi-style surge work in Afghanistan? Could pushing the Taliban deeper into Pakistan feed a larger and looming problem? And most important of all, why does America think its fate in Afghanistan will be different than the former empires that tread here before? I'm Josh Rushing, and this week, we take a look at the deep and deadly fault lines of Obama's war in Afghanistan. If Barack Obama thought this was going to be straightforward, he is surely beginning to see just how complicated, dirty, and deadly war can be. The fight in Afghanistan may have begun in the months after September 11, 2001, but it's far from any conclusion.
The president has put 21,000 additional Americans into this thing. It's the largest Marine Corps operation since Al-Fajr in Fallujah.
In the next 12 to 18 months, we've got to start to turn this security situation around in Afghanistan.
The military is untouchable. Nobody dares criticize what we're doing there.
The average insurgency where you win takes some 14 years.
We've become the Soviets in Afghanistan, and I feel like the emperor has no clothes and no one's telling him. We are repeating history, and it's a very, very bloody history.
These men are the leading edge of Obama's so-called surge policy. A mass deployment that nearly doubles the number of U.S. troops in Afghanistan to 45,000. Fault Lines is flying out with these soldiers at the invitation of the American military to embed with U.S. forces. We're with the U.S. Marines as they travel toward the front line to take part in what the Pentagon has called Operation Khanjar, or Strike of the Sword. 9,000 new troops are heading to Helmand Province, where the Taliban have for several years had the upper hand. That's where we're headed to. The soldiers we're with are nervous, and they should be. July was the deadliest year for NATO forces since the war in Afghanistan began.
You ready? Ready?
No.
Begin.
Let's go.
The staging point for the surge is Camp Leatherneck in Helmand Province. It's Barack Obama's first military thumbprint on the world. And it's a big one. A vast, sprawling 450 acres in the middle of the desert.
Good job, brother!
Good job, sir.
The buzz here never stops. Day and night, bulldozers move mountains of sand, troops construct buildings, and tons of equipment pours in.
You can't surge personal relations. You can't surge trust. You can't surge cooperation.
General Nicholson is the man in charge, a veteran of the Battle of Fallujah in Iraq. He's keen to follow the Washington line on his mission.
What's your objective here? Is it to crush the Taliban?
No, it's the people. It is to secure the people and crush any Taliban who get in the way of that mission. And again, if we had designed this operation to go after the Taliban, we would have done it in such a very, very different way.
The way Washington has chosen is a so-called counterinsurgency strategy, shifting focus from killing the enemy to winning the trust of the populace, diplomacy over military. But the reality on the ground tells a different story. Operations so far have been almost exclusively military, and the death toll is rising fast. Not just for troops, but for Afghans too. In the first 6 months of 2009, 1,000 civilians were killed in the fighting.
This is not just a military operation. Military isn't going to win this thing. We can provide the security, but then the civilian side of this really has to kick in.
But what I actually think is happening is that the president wants to be quote-unquote successful and relies on people who's supposed to know to help guide the policy, and many of them are deeply entrenched in the status quo, which is heavy emphasis on military solutions.
The first option, all too often, is the military option. I think in Afghanistan, you know, platitudes are offered regarding diplomacy, but the tip of the spear still remains the military.
So is it just platitudes being given to diplomacy? Fault Lines put in several requests to the U.S. State Department to get their perspective on the civilian input in Obama's Afghanistan surge. No interview was forthcoming. To see the counterinsurgency policy taking place on the ground, we flew along the Helmand River to the front lines.
We start looking for wires. They usually remote the battery off somewhere else.
At a forward operating base in the village of Nawa, we met up with Charlie Company as they were getting ready to set off on patrol. It was just 5 days into the surge.
Bad timing. Get this boy out.
Cherokee COC, Cherokee COC, this is 81s.
Here in the front lines, all the talk of building bridges with Afghans and providing aid seems like rhetoric from a different world. To Afghans looking on, this is solely a military presence, and almost entirely a white, Western presence as well.
I am often asked, hey, do you need more Marines? And my answer is no, I need more Afghans. So probably if I have one area I'm concerned about, if I have one weakness right now, it's my lack of Afghan security forces.
You know, those guys, they're definitely the key to winning this thing. It's not us that's going to win it, it's going to be them.
That's our goal. We want to open these roads for everyone.
Experts claim for the U.S. to hand over security operations and withdraw, there needs to be 250,000 Afghan soldiers, a number almost three times the size of the current force.
In Afghanistan, you can't take the surge model from Iraq and just apply it to Afghanistan. The United States controls a teeny tiny section of Afghanistan. So, for the United States to have the hubris to think that we're going to come in and we're going to have 78,000 U.S. troops and we're going to have 100,000 contractors and we're going to have NATO in there and we're going to build up this Afghan army, history laughs at that kind of logic.
This was supposed to be a Taliban stronghold. The Marines expected a big fight. But after they landed, they said the Taliban disappeared like ghosts. They went to ground, which makes the first part of the Marines' mission to clear it easier. But raises the question, how do you ever defeat an enemy that you can't actually fight?
Now they realize we use that road a lot, so they went ahead and they IED'd the shit out of it, I guess, from a local just told us, so probably back here tomorrow to clear that out.
While the Taliban might not be fighting around Nawa, they did leave behind dozens of IEDs.
All right, we got a possible IED out on the road there. The engineers are taking a look. He got a hit with the minesweeper about that big.
1 minute!
It's not really what I expected. So I was pretty busy the first week or so, but I scared them all off. Now we're just looking for IEDs.
It might not be intensive fighting, but roadside bombs are taking their toll.
I cannot get from there.
There's a lot of mines?
Yeah.
Where?
In June, the total number of improvised explosive devices, or IEDs, was 736, a record for the fourth straight month. While the Marines focus on Helmand, the Taliban are everywhere in Afghanistan. A leaked document from the Afghan government estimates that around 50% of the country is either in the Taliban's control or at high risk of attack. If the U.S. is successful and the Taliban are pushed out of Helmand, it's easy for them to move somewhere else to fight, either across the border in Pakistan or in other provinces. U.S. leaders are coming around to the idea that Afghanistan is impossible to win militarily. At some point, the Taliban must be brought into the political process.
The problem here is reconciliation and amnesty programs have been used in every successful counterinsurgency without exception.
Well, I think with any insurgency, and certainly the Taliban's an example, you have a hardcore group that you're never going to turn around, and they're going to have to be either killed or captured, somehow eliminated.
If it causes maybe some of the mid and lower level Taliban to say, hey, I want to stay in my hometown, I don't want any more of this, I want to reconcile, I see that Afghan flag and I believe in that flag, then that's a great thing.
During campaigning for the national elections, the Taliban's role in the process was far from the kind of participation the U.S. was hoping for. Fighting between the Taliban and U.S. forces across the country intensified. Several high-profile bomb attacks, including one at NATO headquarters in Kabul, are proof the Taliban are prepared to make real their threats of violence against Afghans considering voting. The continuing violence raises very real questions, such as whether a U.S.-imposed democratic system is really the best way to create stability in the country.
I think for a time we thought we needed to transform Afghanistan like we hoped to transform Iraq. And I think that's a mission that's beyond our capability.
So you don't see democracy flourishing in Afghanistan?
I think we can encourage it. But Afghanistan is a big country. It has a very different history. And I just don't think that we have the ability or the patience to stay there long enough to see that happening.
I think that we need to back off of our arrogance and really try to understand that there may be alternative systems of governance that would make Afghanistan a much more secure nation.
Khanishim, on the Afghanistan-Pakistan border. It's a place the U.S. military was desperate for us to see. Diverting a helicopter just to pick up the fault lines team.
Nice smoke cloud.
Joining the U.S. military, the governor of Helmand was there to raise the flag over what was until recently a Taliban stronghold. Off camera, General Nicholson told us this was the Afghans' Iwo Jima moment.
It's a big moment.
A moment the military did their best to turn into a big media event as well. They clearly wanted audiences in the States and around the world to know that Operation Khanjar had reached the Pakistan border and send a message that Helmand was being turned back over to the Afghans.
Just over my shoulder is Pakistan. There's nothing but desert in between here and Pakistan. So if you're coming north from Pakistan, as the Taliban do, to come into Afghanistan, this is a traditional stopping point, a staying point. It was one of the first towns they took in the Marine operation, Strike of the Sword.
And just across the border, there's another war being fought, with perhaps even greater consequences. Pakistan, not Afghanistan, is where bin Laden and Al-Qaeda are thought to be.
Where is Al-Qaeda on your list of priorities and threats around the world?
As far as I'm concerned, it's the top. It's at the top of the list.
And you know that Al-Qaeda is in Fatah. So why is the U.S. not in Fatah?
Because Fatah is in Pakistan, and Pakistan's a sovereign country, and we don't go into sovereign countries.
So is Iraq and Afghanistan.
And we don't go into sovereign countries, and you know, unless we're invited in.
Whether or not the U.S. has been invited into Pakistan, they're certainly there. Currently, the Americans' most visible presence comes in the form of drone attacks. supposedly targeting Taliban and Al-Qaeda leadership. Although the reality is, it's civilians who pay the highest cost. The attacks have killed around 700 to date.
When they're used with great discrimination and great precision, they can be very useful. But when they're not, they can be very destructive to our own goal.
Clearly, when you have a drone strike that kills a wedding party of 90 people, when you're really after one person, maybe even you didn't get that person, this contributes to the problem. This allows hostiles to say, see, this is against Islam, this is against our way of life, and it fuels that fire.
The U.S. is pumping billions of dollars of aid into the Pakistani armed forces to fund their fight against the Pakistani Taliban and Al-Qaeda. And the Americans are expanding their diplomatic influence in the country.
$787 million has been budgeted now to build this huge U.S. compound in Islamabad. The message that sends, that building that kind of a structure sends, is one of contradicting the official line that we're not going to stay here forever. Building those kinds of facilities sends a message that the U.S. is there to stay.
Some even argue that U.S. actions in Pakistan foster the very instability that America claims is trying to quell. A recent Al Jazeera poll found that Pakistan is considered the United States, not the Taliban, to be the greatest threat to their country.
It should be scary to Americans to hear the results of that Al Jazeera poll, because it really yanks naked the cold hard fact, and that is that the United States is losing in every possible way in Pakistan and Afghanistan.
So what do some of the Afghans, who the U.S. says it is trying to help, actually think? Jazia Shakib, not a real name, is a member of the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan and a Kabul resident. We're concealing her identity over fears for her safety.
The new strategy of Obama to send another more than 20,000 troops to Afghanistan is like a bad news to Afghan people. They are bombing under the name of killing Taliban. They are just bombing different villages. They are killing ordinary people. This is not liberation. This is invasion, occupation, and just destroying lives.
Like many in Afghanistan, Shazia believes the country's problems can only be solved by Afghans.
History has shown that no country can grant freedom, peace, democracy, all these values to another country as a gift. Because this is the responsibility of our own people to attain and to achieve all these values.
On our way back from Nawa, we passed through the Kandahar Air Base. The city, recently a Taliban stronghold, was founded by Alexander the Great and fought over by conquerors ever since. Now, 30,000 troops enjoy a surprising variety of wartime luxuries, such as hockey, volleyball, and a French cafe. Built by the Bush administration, it's a carbon copy of the huge superbases in Iraq, mostly run by for-profit contractors.
In the second quarter of 2009, President Obama increased the number of security contractors in Afghanistan by about 29%. They still operate with very shaky accountability structure in both Afghanistan and Iraq. In fact, Blackwater operatives in May allegedly shot an Afghan civilian whose car came too close to them, in a very similar story to that which has happened repeatedly in Iraq. And this is this is causing problems in diplomatic circles between the Afghans and the Americans. You almost have an Iraq scenario playing out again.
Perhaps it's unsurprising that this administration isn't that different from its predecessor and how it fights wars.
Since 2001, you know, we've seen our military budget go from about $290 billion a year to close to $700 billion a year.
You know that Hillary Clinton was the number one recipient of defense industry dollars in the 2008 campaign? The Democrats got more money from the war industry than the Republicans. Why? The war industry is an equal opportunity giver. They don't care who's in power. They just want to be on the right side of power.
We have allowed diplomacy and development to atrophy.
You know, war is a racket, like Smedley Butler said, but it's also business. And business has been very, very good in the U.S. since 9/11 when it comes to the war industry.
Perhaps the greatest battle the U.S. faces in Afghanistan is not a military one, but rather a war of perception. The fight is to persuade Afghans and the Muslim world as a whole that this is not an occupation.
We're not here to build an empire, we're here to build a foundation. And I think there are no colonial aspirations here, never have been.
We're not an occupation force, and it's up to us to make sure that that message is loud and clear.
This is a spit in the ocean of history, and the United States is repeating a mistake that was made by the British, made by the Russians, and why do we think we're going to succeed? What, we're somehow smarter than other empires that tried to do it? No.
While it's easy to imagine all the ways Afghanistan and the war here can go wrong, what is proving more difficult is envisioning how it can go right. When recently asked, what is victory for the U.S. in Afghanistan, the U.S. ambassador to the region, Richard Holbrooke, gave the perplexing answer, he'll know it when he sees it. President Obama has made considerable political mileage by claiming he's inherited the mess in Afghanistan from the Bush administration. Now, the stakes have never been higher, especially for Afghans. More soldiers, more contractors, more deaths, and no end in sight. And with the surge of troops, this is now very much Obama's war.